This podcast is brought to you by American Dope.
Okay, Courtney, so in 1973, you were what, 12?
73, I'm 9 years old.
You're 9 years old, and this is when
going on 10.
Your family's house appears on the front page of the biggest newspapers in Detroit. You're on all three channels of the news, and this was kind of the last era when a gangster or a drug dealer would be enough of a celebrity and an important economic force in a big city like Detroit that, you know, this was the biggest story in town for the summer of 73. And here we have Milton Henry, who was your father and Eddie's lawyer, kind of negating some of the stuff that was going on.
Well, yeah, you know, they had leaked the, now that I'm older, I didn't know, of course, it's at 10 years old, but the authorities had leaked the indictment to the press. They had put our homes on the front page, and that's what Milton's kind of trying to explain there. You know, this guy's a former Tuskegee Airman.
Well, I was going to say, in a nutshell, I mean, to really get a sense of the level that Eddie and your father are operating at nationally, let's talk about their lawyer. Who was Milton Henry?
Milton Henry, Malcolm X's, obviously the civil rights great leader.
He was his Malcolm X's chief legal defense.
Chief legal defense and just confidant. If you read anything about like Malcolm's travels, like when Malcolm was poisoned in Africa, it was Milton Henry who drove him to the hospital. But if you even go further back in his career, this guy has had a degree in physics from Temple, Yale Law degree, Yale Divinity degree.
Probably one of the top 10 lawyers in the United States and certainly the top black lawyer in the United States.
Without question. A legal scholar, really respected. He had already, by this time, he had already been in front of the United States Supreme Court.
Your father and Eddie were allowed to stay out on bail for several years, and they were sort of still operating. And because of the tenor of the times, racial strife, there was a little bit of maybe a shield that was able to be provided, that your father's organization wasn't killing people, they weren't dating white women, like you said, so they were kind of allowed to stay on the street. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, yeah, and you know, looking back now to put it in context, Nixon and the whole Nixon administration was all real pro-black business. Eddie had a huge real estate, legitimate real estate holdings.
He paid $400,000 in taxes 1 year.
Cash money, $400,073 money. So you're talking about easily $4 million today's money. The old man had a real estate management office, my dad, right? So on one hand, although they were arch villains, I guess, or major organized crime figures on one hand, on the other hand, they were the absolute pillar of what the Nixon administration and what Ebony and Jet were. My mom is, we're living in the suburbs, we're playing Little League baseball.
You have interior houses being done by
interior decorators. On just the surface, we were the quote unquote black success story.
Mr. Brown and Mr. Jackson have paid better than $450,000 in income tax. I think that's more than some of the corporations, Shell, Atlantic Richfield, and a few of the others. Now, for Mr. Leff, who's in charge of the task force to try this case in the newspaper and get the public sentiment against these two gentlemen, I think that's reprehensible. Mr. Jackson has legitimate income on which he pays income tax. That's more than can be said for a whole lot of folks.
Mr. Jackson, it's alleged that just 6 years ago you were earning a little better than $3 an hour as an auto production worker. Just how did you come to acquire this home in Southfield and your other business interests, your automobiles?
Well, I think the law states, you know, that you have to file your income. You know, if I tell you that, you know, then you know my secrets, you know. But as long as I file my income, and I think this is what the law states, you know, and I do that.
Do you deny flatly that you are in any way tied in with the illegal drug
trafficking? Yes, I do.
Would you care to reveal just what your business holdings are, how you've acquired this wealth?
No, it is a matter of record. You know, if you want to check on that, you can check.
It's a matter of record. You're saying that you have property?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm.
How did you acquire the property? Would you mind telling us that, sir?
If I tell you that, then you'll know my business. Well, I think through wise investments and, really just wise investments. Mm-hmm.
You're under constant surveillance. There have been all kinds of stories about your alleged connections with the underworld drug market. What's your reaction, Mr. Jackson?
Well, as far as the connection, that's 100% false. And as far as the surveillance, I welcome, you understand, anybody who feel like they want to waste their time watching me, you understand, well, then they can just go ahead and watch me.
Again, the question, how could a man at the age of 29, who just 6 years ago was earning something like $6,000 a year, acquire so much in so short a time?
Well, I think you asked me before about I worked in the pool room. I want to straighten that out. I own the pool room. Also, the block proceeded to that, you know. And from that and manipulating, you understand, and I just came, you know, fortunately, you understand, and came up to this.
This American Dope podcast is part of the Motown Mafia series. Check out the other podcasts in this series.
Okay, Courtney, so this is your house,
that's
right?
Eddie's house. We're right next to Eddie's next door. So you got the Cadillac, you got Mercedes, you got another Cadillac, you got his crowd pleaser, Rolls Royce.
Yeah, so that's
in the backyard, Olympic-sized swimming pool with steam room next to it.
And who were the other black residents of the neighborhood?
Well, Smokey Robinson lived about eight houses down. Otis Wilson of the Temptation, two blocks down. Pete Moore of the Miracles, right next door.
This is interior
Eddie's house, right. Charles Smith, the founder of .NET, a shrimp shack, which was a big, you know, seafood franchise back in the 70s. The members of Holland Doja Holler, who wrote a lot of the Motown songs. Actually, and then, you know, it was a heavily still Jewish community at that point in Southfield, so a lot of the more prominent Jewish entrepreneurs.
Okay, here's the Rolls Royce.
That's the Rolls.
Crowd Pleaser.
Crowd Pleaser wrote on it.
That's what Eddie was known as.
That was his handle
and
there.
And he would throw money.
More than a few times he would ride through the ride down the street and just throw money out the window.
So that's where that kind of originated.
Do you
think people did that before them, or that era of guys started just too many $1 bills, throw it in the air?
Well, he didn't just throw ones out. He didn't just throw singles out the window, but
fives and tens and 20s?
I mean, from reliable sources, guys that roll with him, it was nothing. If you caught him on the right day, he might throw $40,000 to $50,000 out the window. Yeah.
$40,000 to $50,000 in 1972, which is like $1 million.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess that was what was the, yeah.
Now, and your father kind of helped jumpstart the future drug empire by helping Eddie just get a small, like, what, $2,000 judgment from the auto plant?
Three to be exact, back when, you know, they were lifelong friends. And yeah, you know, my dad was kind of always the neighborhood, you know, back then if you had a high school diploma, you did good in school, that made you, that was like having a doctorate degree. Like, you know, when eighth grade was considered a big deal, and this guy would get good grades all the way. So anyway, yeah, Eddie asked him to help him out with a workman's comp loan or claim. My old man helped him out. He got him $3,000.
And that was eventually parlayed into multi-million, biggest drug rings in the United States.
Well, and what is a safe assessment is that between 1969 to 1977, with only possible exception, Berry Gordy, Eddie Jackson was the richest black man in the state of Michigan. And the class of him and Berry Gordy and whoever was number three, they were a long way down. It was a distant third.
Wow.
Yeah. It was a different time. But again, you know, on one side they were these great underworld figures, but I think a lot of the relief that they got and why they were allowed to stay out on appeal bond after being found guilty.
Because some of their biggest earning years, they were out on bond. They were under indictment and were still rolling.
Yeah, the majority of their criminal enterprise happened post-indictment, while out on appeal bonds as they went through the district courts, the circuit courts, all the way up until the end.
Why do you think they were allowed? I mean, that wouldn't happen now.
I think, A, there was no violence involved. And as we kind of joke, but it's not a joke, a couple of the social norms that allow you not to get on the government's or the... They didn't sell drugs in the suburbs. Their business affairs were in...
We're
in the black community in old traditional black neighborhoods around people that they had actually grew up with. Whatever you want to say or don't say, these guys paid. My old man has sent hundreds of people to college. He's paid hundreds of people's mortgages. Eddie probably sent thousands of kids to college and paid thousands of people's mortgages and invested in and kept hundreds of African-American businesses afloat. Because let's be honest, when Chase Bank or Bank of America or Comerica isn't going to give you that small business loan, who do you go to?
And he probably didn't even ask for it back.
And he didn't ask for it back. And what he definitely didn't ask you for a credit score. If you said, "Look, man, I've caught some hard times. I'm falling behind.
$2,000 to keep my business.
To keep my business, keep you going. All I'm gonna do, I'm gonna come in and eat free every day."
Log on to www.americandope.com and check out our store.
So, I think that and that the authorities really saw that there was no violence associated with the organization. The fact that it was kept mainly, in the black community, away from the suburbs, no implication that there were white kids being involved or young white girls being corrupted. So basically, like, they mind their business, they keep it in their community.
No one's getting killed.
Nobody's getting killed. And as far as their suburban neighbors account, these guys are upstanding suburban businessmen.
Your dad was coach of your Little League team.
Dad's coach of Little League team. My mom is, hosting the Girl Scout and Brownie parties,
Did they get
dad
shunned?
Dad, members of the Lynx Club.
And did they get shunned at all by the community after the news, the news stories? Or you were too young to really be able to
tell? I tell you, people are all the same. If you're on TV, it's like they say in business, there's no such thing as bad publicity. Because if you're on TV, that makes you famous. And people like to be nice to people who are famous.
For whatever.
And then, if you're being told by the authorities and the media that these guys are major underworld figures, who wants to piss off the major underworld figure?
So your family social life just continued kind of normal, even while their case was wending through the courts and while they were still controlling the streets.
Well, yeah, I remember our maid, when this story and all this first hit, and my mom is going through something that morning in March when it comes out, and the maid's about to come in. And she's, my mom was relatively young, but anyway, she was basically like, "Oh, we got to explain to, God rest her soul, Miss Frazier, what's going on with all of this stuff." And Miss Frazier was an older African-American woman, and she basically was like, "Honey, what do you think I thought was going on? Who lives like this?" She's like, "You guys are in your late, mid-20s and early 20s, and you're living like..."
Yeah.
The baby Rockefellers, you think, I'm an old lady, I've been around. It's like, "Honey, it's not my concern. I take good care of your kids, you're happy with my work,
and
you pay me 20 times the going rate to clean up a house." So, and again, the paper boys are getting $300 tips. Obviously, the homes were kept impeccable. We made this call. And when you're around other people, not to get into the whole class issue, when you're around other people of a certain economic level, the people don't pass judgment.
Because you know what they're doing.
You got the jeweler down the street, he's doing all types of things. The banker is dealing with all kinds of individuals. And I'm just going to throw it out there, people take it how they want to take it. Only poor people got the time to make moral judgments. People in the world of getting money, and that be sports, entertainment, banking, finance, narcotics, underworld, entertainment. People getting money hang out and know people who get money and understand that at a certain level, everything becomes very, very small. So no, we didn't. My sister, I guess, got some off the wall comments, which is what led to what my dad's talking about.
She was sent to the most prominent private school in Metro Detroit. And that was only thanks to your father's bail bondsman suggesting, "Hey, your kids need to go here." So really, that's interesting. Even if your father had the money he had, without him meeting some of the people he met in the underworld who even advised things to do in terms of education for his children, it really opened up whole new vistas. And your sister went on to become a lawyer.
Correct. Again, their case was, I guess, one of the better cases, because the path early on, I think Eddie's ascension and then with the old man as his chief associate, chief advisor, they very quickly started moving into different circles. One, Eddie was running with the Motown crowd, was running after him. But with that comes top lawyers, top accountants, top advisors in all different spectrums. So you start hearing conversations about what you need to do with your money besides being involved in the underworld, how to legitimize your money. You might want to send your kids to here. Or, you know, rich, if you're, even if you're, people are people. You're in the underworld, you're at the nicest clothing store in the city. The guy who's the big shot, who owns the car dealership, or maybe when Eddie's buying one of his 100 Cadillacs that he bought, he's talking to the guy who owns Dave Rice, who owns the Cadillac dealer, or Floyd Rice, who owns the Cadillac dealer. Where do you send your kids to? Or where do you guys go on vacation?
Where do you get your jewelry?
Where do you get
your shop? Where do your kids go to school, et cetera? Who's your accountant?
Right. So, and that's why we're like...
What stocks did you buy?
We traveled a lot because you hear from your lawyer's wife that her and her friends just went on a cruise to South America. The mom would come home and be like, I think I want to go to South America. Or, you know, right, this is where they buy their jewelry at, and then you get to know the right jeweler, and then the jeweler knows the right banker. And you learn the world. You learn how the world really works, and that's what I think allowed these guys to really separate them from the typical street hustler story. Besides the fact they were just making a lot more money than the average guy in the street.
Well, like I say, the economy has grown since then. Drug dealers are kind of the same. I mean, but like you said, back then, Eddie Jackson, it was him and Berry Gordy were the two wealthiest black men in the state of Michigan. And certainly today, the second wealthiest black man in the state of Michigan is not a drug dealer or a criminal.
Well, at least they haven't been indicted.
Well, I would think so many athletes making $8, $10, $12, $15 million a year alone.
I mean, I get what you're saying, and I agree. I just would give the audience one moment of cause. The biggest drug dealers are the ones you never heard of. Not everybody gets caught. The best ones, and these guys were Hall of Fame quality, but the best ones are the ones you never know. So we'll never know, and we'll know about Eddie Jackson. You'll know about Frank Matthews because you know about all the guys who eventually got indicted. But the ones you never do know about is the one that never got caught. And that was true then, and that's true now. And that's the other part that, of course, authorities don't like.
Well, the biggest drug dealers now are Pfizer and Merck. So.
And they probably always have been, and assuredly are now, yeah. And I don't know that there's too many guys.
The movie industry saturating the black mentality with a death wish.
Street corner indoctrination, it's overpowering.
Drugs were in the black community. Nobody really cared.
The African-American community has quite a debt to what we would consider a criminal enterprise.
According to leading researchers, Negroes buy more quality products than any other comparable United States group.
Their parents had struggled and marched and wanted to make sure that they were extremely successful and to go as far as their talents could take them, suddenly got involved in drugs, and the drug was heroin. So it was just destroying the African-American community.
We don't want welfare, colonialism in the black ghetto. The basic issue has to do with whether or not we can control some employment for ourselves.
White powder, black power is the story of how the illegal drug economy was the first truly large and widespread capital building tool for African Americans.
I mean, they may be colorful, they may be glamorous, they may give turkeys on Thanksgiving, they may support a little league baseball team, but they're selling a substance that's gonna kill your child or your grandchild.
I'm not condoning what they do. What I'm simply saying is that there are many on that playing field. And so when we demonize one group and then another group, we just kind of smile and look the other way.
Jews, the Irish. I mean, as every group in America has attempted to go to the next level economically, the story of organized crime and narcotics has played a part in it.
This American Dope podcast is part of the Motown Mafia series. Check out the other podcasts in this series. Log on to www.americandope.com and check out our store.